Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. While it's certainly true that there is often no love lost between political rivals, especially in Washington, the U.S. also has a tradition of ex-presidents and sitting presidents getting along, even becoming allies, even across the partisan divide. So today we've invited two presidential historians on the program to discuss relationships between the men who have occupied the Oval Office. They are a well-known name to Iowa Public Radio listeners. Tim Walsh, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, welcome back.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
Tim number two is Tim Naftali, clinical associate professor of public service and history at New York University, former director of the Nixon Library, also co-author of Impeachment and American History. Tim Naftali, thank you for joining us, I assume, from New York City.
Indeed, and it's a pleasure to be with the other Tim and you too, Ben.
All right. Well, before we delve into the history of presidential relationships, by the way, we'd like to have our listeners ask questions, make comments about relationships between our presidents, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Before we delve into that discussion, I'd like to ask the two of you to share your thoughts on the historic times our nation is struggling with at the moment. These twin crises of the coronavirus pandemic, massive loss of lives due to it, also the way it's crashed our economy like no time since the Great Depression, and the second crisis, more recent, the massive outpouring of civil unrest over police brutality, racism sparked by the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, civil unrest over the unequal treatment of U.S. citizens. These are the themes we're dealing with. And I know that the contemporary civil rights history may not be in your specific areas of research and scholarship, gentlemen, but I wonder if you could just offer some brief observations. Tim Walsh, may I start with you?
Sure, Ben. I was reading the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago. I came across a great quote from Ron Chernow, in which he talks about how difficult it is for historians, particularly in this era, to differentiate between the events we're living in and exactly whether or not the patterns of today will be critical for how we interpret this era. So we are individuals, of course. We're citizens. In some cases, we're active and involved in different issues. We're concerned, of course, about our economy and the welfare of our citizens, health, and then also social justice. It occurred to me, too, when we raised this issue, I was born in 1947, so I'm 72, and I've lived through multiple waves of social issues related to racial injustice and so forth, starting with the Civil Rights Revolution in 1957 and the 1960s. I graduated from college in 1970 when the campuses were disrupted by concern over the Vietnam War. And then going forward, we've seen multiple cases of racial injustice. Certainly the most recent with George Floyd, but we're a country almost caught up in revolution and in social injustice and in engagement, almost going back to the days of the American Revolution. So as an historian, I realize I'm caught up in events as a participant and hope that my successors down the road, future historians, will be able to discern the importance of the events Tim and I are living through.
Mm-hmm. Tim Naftali, your reflections.
I keep thinking about how this moment is different from those before us. I do that because it's so easy for us, as Tim alluded to, those of us who've studied history, to look for comforting parallels. I say comforting because mm-hmm. we know how it ended, and we know that the issue, or at least that moment, passed, and something perhaps better followed it. It's the uncertainty of the current moment that puts many historians intellectually at sea. We're not very good at predicting the future. But I wanted to offer a few notes about how things are a little different from those moments that people seem to point to right now, like 1968. The movement that we see on the streets, that I see here in New York City, doesn't have one or two leaders. Like those movements for social justice that we observe from afar in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world in this digital age, this movement is self-generated. This is generated by people who are following social media, who are reacting to events and who want to show that they want change and that they are engaged. And that's very different from some of the organized protests in the Vietnam period. The other thing that is quite significant is the amount of peaceful protesting that we're seeing. Yes, there was horrific looting in this city, in New York City, on Sunday night and Monday night, and there was violence on Saturday night. No doubt about it. But for the most part, what we are seeing, those of us in New York City, and I suspect that's true elsewhere in the country where there are protests, is that these protests are massive and they're peaceful. So I would be careful about talking about social civil unrest. I think that meme is being used by the president to justify sending images of domination.
What would you call it then, Tim Naftali?
I would say that we are seeing peace. I'm saying we are seeing people who are, for the most part, there has been violence, and we should not, and I do not condone violence, but we are seeing a peaceful. It's not a revolution because I don't think this, but we are seeing a peaceful rebellion against the status quo in the streets and a demand for change. This is political action, but peaceful and therefore constitutional political action. The next part that is different is that the main instigator of disorder at this point, I really am using my words carefully, is the President of the United States. He is actually not promoting civil peace. He may be promoting order in his own mind, but it's not civil peace. His predecessors responded to the call from the street for action by trying to understand. Even Richard Nixon, who for the most part was allergic to dissent, even Richard Nixon went out amongst demonstrators one long, peculiar night in May of 1970 to try to interact and figure them out and explain his point of view. But this president isn't listening. This president is building a barrier to push the public even further away from the people's house. That's very different. So I don't know where this is going to go, but what I worry about is that the actions of our national leaders, for the most part, are encouraging inflammation and instability, not seeking a peaceful way out. It is as if they want a dead end, and that worries me.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, let's wrap this up, because we do want to get to talk about the fascinating thoughts you have on relationships between presidents. But very quickly, all presidents in their time have distinct images that become historically connected with their time in office. While we don't know how it will go down in history, I wonder what you think as historians about what happened Monday in Lafayette Square next to the White House when peaceful protesters were forcefully cleared to make way for the president to stand next to a church holding a Bible in his hand for cameras. Tim Walsh, is that an image that will be forever connected with this presidency? Is it likely, no matter, not saying how it will be interpreted, but that is an image, right?
Oh, without question. I mean, using a national symbol like St. John's Church, and then the whole act of clearing away peaceful demonstrators, this picks up on exactly what Tim is talking about. President Trump is unprecedented, and he's a paradigm shift as far as how presidents have responded to periods of crisis. Presidents almost by definition, or at least the presidency by definition, was to bring people together, to follow in a common cause, to soothe people's ills, to tell them that a president has a vision for going forward. As Tim so eloquently states, clearly states, this president basically has said, I want to divide. And so anyone who does not adulate and adore me is going to be pushed aside, as was the case with those peaceful demonstrators in Lafayette Square. Lafayette Square is like Hyde Park. It's where people go and protest and express themselves day in, day out, 365 days a year. And to push them out of the way and then to go across the street in this hastily arranged kind of photo op, and then kind of mishold the Bible, and to do this without the permission of the Bishop of Washington, almost defiles a sacred space and adds to the problem rather than contributing to the solution.
Mm-hmm. A last quick word, if you have it, Tim Naftali, before we do move on.
We don't know yet whether that image will be associated with farce or tragedy, and it depends on what happens in the next few days and weeks. I hope it'll be seen as a farcical image that encapsulates this president's efforts to pretend to be a leader and a strong man. But I don't know what's about to happen.
Tim Naftali is with us from New York City, former director of the Nixon Library, now at New York University. Tim Walz, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, our two presidential historians. Let's move to our focus for the rest of this hour, a discussion about the history of relationships between the men who've occupied the Oval Office. Tim Walz, when we started this series on River to River back in 2016, I believe, it was because it was clear from the start, wasn't it, Tim, that our newly elected president was ignoring many of the traditions and presidential norms we've seen in recent presidents of either party. Donald Trump promised his supporters during the campaign there would be no business as usual. And indeed, he has delivered in that in so many ways. And so we've had this series of discussions over the past more than 3 years now to put Donald Trump's unconventional approach to the presidency in historical context. We've all been taking in the recent news of the rising animosity between Donald Trump, for instance, and his predecessor, Barack Obama. That is the jumping off point in terms of news that inspired this discussion. Perhaps we'll want to reflect on that toward the end of the hour, the deteriorating relationship between those two. But first, let's dig deep into the history of presidential relationships. Tim Walz, take us by the hand into our time porthole of presidential history. Where do we start in this discussion?
Well, presidents don't govern by themselves or on their own, despite what Donald Trump might suggest. And in fact, going back even to George Washington, of course, becomes president in 1789 and has a cabinet that includes Thomas Jefferson, a future president, and his colleague and not running mate, but the vice president of the United States, John Adams. And all three men, of course, have to have a working relationship. Now, Adams at that point is a president of the Senate and doesn't have much work to do directly with the cabinet. But the relationship among and between these men then leads the direction going forward. Washington kind of holds together the government. Adams becomes president, tries to bring Thomas Jefferson in. So reaching across party lines, wants to bring Jefferson into the government as his vice president. Jefferson refuses. And so going forward, the relationship between these two men is acrimonious until Benjamin Rush, later in their lives, when both Adams and Jefferson are retired and looking back on their careers from the time of the Continental Congress forward, they begin to write letters to one another and kind of find a measure of peace. But thereafter, throughout the 19th century, presidents have sort of selected somebody from within their cabinet as a kind of a junior partner to bring them forward. So James Monroe with his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, who then becomes president, and Andrew Jackson has Martin Van Buren, first as a Secretary of State and then a Vice President. And so there is a relationship between presidents and then future presidents. Where we begin to see a person leaving the office of president and then kind of coming back to public life is with Theodore Roosevelt in the 20th century. He leaves in 1909. He's basically decided very quickly after he left the presidency that it was a mistake. He travels around the world. He gets restless, makes a decision to run for president in 1912, opposing his good friend and designated heir, so to speak, William Howard Taft. Of course, Theodore Roosevelt doesn't win the presidency back. He loses to Woodrow Wilson. Taft finishes third, and Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt become sort of acrimonious rivals of a sort, two sides of the political philosophy, and those two really don't have much of a relationship. But then Wilson brings into government, not Theodore Roosevelt, but he brings Taft back into government as co-chair of the War Industries Board during World War I, and then, of course, grooms two future presidents in Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt. Mm. So there's always been, going forward from Washington all the way through now to Wilson, a relationship between sitting presidents and future presidents. And then now in the 20th century, we have a relationship between former presidents and the person in office.
Mm-hmm. Tim Walsh, I know you're writing, your research is focused a lot, of course, on Herbert Hoover's relationships with presidents from Wilson, as you demonstrated, to LBJ, especially with Truman and Eisenhower. Tim Naftali, you have really, in your research, focused on more recent presidential relationships?
Yes, I have. In fact, I'm working on a book at the moment about John F. Kennedy's presidency, but I've also looked at other presidential relationships. In the Cold War especially, there was an added dimension to the kinds of relationships that Tim Walsh was talking about. Because in the Cold War, you had a level of highly classified information about highly classified programs that presidents shared. Programs would begin under one president and continue under one or two or perhaps three successors. And so there were operations that they understood and they could confer about. Indeed, what would become a tradition was that days before the inauguration, the soon-to-be former president would discuss with the president-elect the programs, the major problems of the world that that president-elect was about to inherit. So that added a dimension, a business dimension, if you will, to the shared experience of being president of the United States. Gerald Ford, at the 200th anniversary of the founding and building of the White House, described the so-called President's Club as an exclusive trade union. There is something very unusual about the responsibilities and the knowledge that these men, and someday one would hope women, share. And that has usually, but not always, drawn them together. I hope that Tim and I will discuss some examples of where presidents who should have worked together actually didn't.
Mm-hmm. In your talk about the briefing that presidents, soon-to-be former presidents, give the new presidents, it's also something that really, as an American, makes me proud. It does demonstrate that we have a common course in our government. And it's something that Tim Walsh, that separates us from dictatorships. If we think about a dictatorship, one dictator giving guidelines and advice to the next one, that just doesn't work, right?
No, it doesn't. And obviously, in many countries that don't have stable democracies such as ours, you don't have that peaceful transition of power. And as Tim suggests, that the presidency is larger than any one individual. And when you get a cult of personality that affects how a president sees himself and his predecessors, it complicates and diminishes the office that they're holding. And the issues that each president faces are almost by definition going to continue on into the next administration. And even to the extent, as Tim alludes to, with John F. Kennedy, when we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy wisely thought it was best to inform all of his predecessors as former presidents, even if they had not had an issue with Cuba. So he did call Herbert Hoover and Harry S. Truman to inform them of what was going on in Cuba and to brief them and to get their counsel. He had, of course, worked with Eisenhower and talked to Eisenhower as well. But that's important. It's important that it's not just a club, but it's a tradition and a continuity, and that presidents learn from their predecessors, immediate predecessors, and to some extent to learn from the historical presidents who had preceded them, and then not, in effect, claim that they and they alone are unique, because they're not. They're part of a continuous tradition.
Mm-hmm. We only have a minute. Yeah, go ahead, Tim, in New York.
In these troubled times, I think it would be worthwhile to talk about moments when presidents from different parties work together and why. So I'd like to propose a few, and I know Tim can too.
Give us, we have about a minute before we go to break. Give us a little teaser for when we come back, Tim Naftali.
Gerald Ford helped Jimmy Carter pass the Panama Canal Treaty Panama Canal Treaty passed in 1978. Dwight Eisenhower helped John F. Kennedy get the UN bond bill, which we can discuss, passed in the early 1960s. There are other instances, NAFTA. We can go into this. But presidents have often worked together from different parties.
Okay. We'll be back in just a minute with our presidential historians. We're so happy to have their insights today, talking about history, but making the historical context so real for us because of our national crises, our twin crises at the current time. What an important time to be tied into our presidential history. Tim Walsh is with us, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Naftali from New York City. He's the former director of the Nixon Library, now at the New York University. We invite you to join our conversation with your questions about presidential relationships. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And as Tim Naftali alluded to, when we come back, we'll talk about how presidents have worked together. Perhaps it's a model for today, or should be an aspiration for future presidents. We'll talk about it when we come back with Tim Naftali, Tim Walsh, our presidential historians. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
So good to have you on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with two esteemed presidential historians. Tim Naftali is with us, former director of the Nixon Library. He's now at New York University, joins us from New York City Live, where he's at NYU. He's clinical associate professor of public service and history there. Tim Walsh is with us as well, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Two individuals who've written a lot, done a lot of scholarly work on presidents, and we're tapping into their expertise right now to look at presidential relationships in the past, though they can instruct us in these difficult times, we hope. We know there's not a lot of love lost between political rivals, especially in Washington, but we are learning there can be partnership and goodwill even across the partisan divide. When we left off, Tim Naftali, you were wanting to go into some examples here. An example, what is a good example of perhaps even crossing the partisan divide, one president to the other, to benefit our nation?
Well, there are a number, but I'd like to start by mentioning one that's been forgotten, but it was very significant politically. In 1978, the Carter administration followed up on negotiations with the Panamanian government over the future of the Panama Canal that had actually started under Lyndon Johnson and had accelerated under Gerald Ford. And this led to an agreement with the Panamanian government to give back the canal at a certain point in the future. This was a very controversial treaty. I said it's been forgotten, but it was a flashpoint. And it was very controversial within the changing Republican Party. Indeed, future President Ronald Reagan was rallying the conservative base of the Republican Party against this bill. Gerald Ford helped as best he could get the votes, Republican votes, that Carter needed to pass the treaty in the Senate. In fact, I was just looking at Carter's diary, where he writes in March of 1978. He says, Gerald Ford called and he contacted a number of senators. I appreciate his help. He's done everything he promised. In the NAFTA debate in the 1990s, former President Bush, then with George Herbert Walker Bush, helped Bill Clinton. In 1962, again, another issue that's fallen to the wayside, but when the Soviets stopped paying the United Nations because of their opposition to the United Nations peacekeeping in the Congo, the United Nations was running out of money. And the United States thought it would be a good idea, at least the Kennedy administration, to lend up to $100 million to the United States, well, to the United Nations. Well, there are a number of white supremacists in Congress who did not want to give money to the United Nations to continue peacekeeping activities in Africa. And President Kennedy went to, I mean, not directly, but indirectly, went to President Eisenhower and asked for his help in rallying Republican votes to pass what was the UN bond legislation of 1962, and it passed. Mm. Both Eisenhower and Kennedy were committed to the United Nations, and Kennedy couldn't get the Democratic votes to pass it. And he needed Republican help, and Dwight Eisenhower helped him get it.
Interesting. Tim Walz, do you have an example? Where do you want to take this?
Absolutely. And in fact, taking the tradition back to the years immediately after World War II, when Harry Truman had the courage to write a letter, a personal letter, to Herbert Hoover, inviting him back to the White House. I mean, Hoover had been a persona non grata for 12 years, had isolated himself from Roosevelt and all things related to the New Deal. Truman said, I'd like to meet you. And he brought him back and said, I'd like to hear what you have to say about European food relief and the decision perhaps to use this new weapon, this atomic bomb, or the war in Japan and so forth. And it began an extraordinary relationship that led Truman to make Hoover the chairman of the President's Famine Emergency Committee, where Hoover traveled to 38 different countries speaking on behalf of Harry Truman to identify the fact that the rest of the world was starving and we needed to provide aid to these allies and friends of the United States. Behind the scenes, Hoover worked with a very isolationist Congress to convince them that they had to support Hoover or Truman's efforts to establish what is now called the Marshall Plan. And then later, after that fact, Truman again calls Hoover and says, I want you to chair a commission on the reorganization of the executive branch of government. The federal government had been so bloated after World War II. And there was a definite need to reduce the size, reorganize, create new agencies like the Department of Defense, and so forth, which Hoover did willingly. Now, you might ask, well, why would Hoover cooperate with Harry Truman? Well, in a way, they were both needed a certain escape from the shadow of Franklin D. Roosevelt, but also Hoover was a workaholic. Who enjoyed having meaningful tasks. Truman needed help. He needed Republican support. And so it was a terrific partnership. I put together a volume, Dwight Miller and I put together a volume of documents exchanged between the two. And although they started a little cautious, they really became friends, particularly after Truman left office in 53. And neither man really got along with Dwight Eisenhower very well. Harry Truman complained to Hoover that Eisenhower wasn't listening to him and taking his advice, and Hoover said, he doesn't listen to me either, Harry. So the bottom line was, on occasion, they sometimes find common adversaries. It is also true, of course, that Hoover did do some work with Eisenhower later, and with John F. Kennedy. It was Hoover who provided, in a mild way, it's toward the end of his life, direct assistance and support for the establishment of the Peace Corps. In fact, George McGovern came to Suite 31A at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in 1961 or 62 and asked Hoover to become the honorary chair of the Peace Corps. He was a little too old at that point. So there are collaborative relationships across party lines, as Tim refers to, and gosh, it would be so valuable to return to that. And there have been many other examples, as I'm sure Tim could share with us.
Uh-huh. I want to, go ahead. We have just over 10 minutes left. Tim Naftali, go ahead. I had another question, but you first. Go ahead.
I just wanted to mention an example of presidential self-discipline. Because we don't see a lot of that these days. Dwight Eisenhower was a very difficult, it appears from the evidence, a very difficult person to deal with for all the public affability. And he, just as he didn't get along with Hoover, he didn't get along with John F. Kennedy. But Eisenhower loved his country. And though he was very unhappy when John Kennedy won, when John Kennedy asked to confer with him after the Bay of Pigs, a complete disaster for the Kennedy administration, Eisenhower could have played politics. After all, he really didn't like Kennedy and thought little of the man. But he did the right thing, and he met with Kennedy at Camp David, and he later described publicly their meeting in a way to help Kennedy. And didn't encourage Republicans to use the Bay of Pigs against Kennedy. In 1963, Dwight Eisenhower did not like the test ban, the limited test ban treaty with the Soviet Union. He had very significant reservations about it. We know this from documents. But he decided that he should not be public about his concerns. In 1963, also had very deep misgivings about the civil rights proposals of the Kennedy administration. He supported equal opportunity for African Americans, but he did not want the federal government, and I think this is a tremendous mistake on the part of Dwight Eisenhower, did not want the federal government to ensure integration of public accommodations, in other words, hotels and bus terminals and golf clubs. In fact, he was a member of a white-only golf club, Augusta National, and he didn't want that. But he didn't go public. And in fact, when President Kennedy asked for his help with Republicans to ensure they supported civil rights efforts, Eisenhower agreed, even though he had private misgivings. And he made those decisions, I think, because he thought of what was necessary for the country, also because he sensed of which direction the country was going into, and instead of being undisciplined and seeking political gain and being an egotist and trying to divide the country, he decided to support a successor, John F. Kennedy.
Mm. Fascinating. Little-known facts, fascinating, from our two presidential historians, Tim Naftali and Tim Walsh. Let me ask you this. This enters the news so often and has in recent weeks. When are former presidents allowed to speak out about the policies of a current president? Tim Walsh, are there unwritten rules? There seem to be unwritten rules. And then at some point, as we've seen in the last few days, George H.W. Bush, also Barack Obama, not holding back, speaking out in a certain way about the current president's policies.
Yeah, well, let's use a term that we use too much these days, which is these are unprecedented times. But as you suggest, there's been a measure of decorum that former presidents and toward their successors should have toward their successors, but also that a sitting president has toward his predecessors. There's mutual respect. They and they alone understand how difficult the tasks are. And even if they disagreed politically or philosophically, they had a respect for the individuals who'd held that office. Unfortunately, with President Trump, who has basically castigated every president to precede him other than Abraham Lincoln, and particularly has become vitriolic toward President Obama and even to some extent both Presidents Bush, there has almost been a call, a cry for presidents like President Bush and President Obama to speak out. In the past, President Hoover would said almost nothing except in a very obtuse and philosophical way, anything critical of the New Deal or of Franklin Roosevelt. No personal, even in private correspondence, would not castigate or criticize Franklin Roosevelt. And in fact, worked with Harry Truman and had a certain respect for Harry Truman and was rarely critical of Dwight Eisenhower in any capacity. And Eisenhower was very careful in the way he respected or commented on isolationist principles that Hoover had expressed. So the bottom line was there was a lot of decorum that is now gone.
Tipnov Tali, let me ask you, why would we have such decorum? I mean, if we can imagine a world where our tradition is not like that, accepting the present moment, but one of, if you're no longer president, as a former president, you're allowed to criticize as you see fit, and the thinking there would be for the betterment of the country, that you launch your criticism where you see it's deserved. Why not that rule?
Well, I think part of it is the fact that the office of the President of the United States contains three different responsibilities. One of them, of course, is Commander-in-Chief, another is head of government, and the third is head of state. And presidents are very, I would think, very sensitive to that third one, especially head of state. They represent the country, if you will, the bald eagle. They're the bald eagle. And so when they leave office, they don't forget the fact that presidents are supposed to be presidents of everyone. And so they have this, I'm sure they have this wrestling issue inside. They're citizens now, ordinary citizens, but they're also former heads of state. And do you criticize the head of state as if that person's a politician, or do you keep in mind that person is the flag? And I think that is the reason you have this decorum. It's not that there's some kind of cabal who doesn't, you know, they're trying to protect each other's prerogatives. I think it's this issue that one of their responsibilities was to represent the United States of America. So I think it's hard for some of them to become politicians again, seeking daily advantage. I mean, I think that's why Eisenhower acted the way he did. Eisenhower was never much of a politician anyway, never liked that whole sort of construct. But I think that's one of the reasons. They sense that they owe it to their successor to treat their successor as the new head of state and not to pretend that they hold these responsibilities. Whereas many Americans want to hear from these statesmen and wise men because they have had those experiences and they understand the norms that are being broken. And I think that's what makes this particular moment, once again, as to use that wonderful term, unprecedented. We have a president who actually doesn't respect presidential norms. Some of the power, he believes, comes from the fact that he has promised his base to destroy the norms because the norms he associates with the establishment. So he's never wanted to respect to give the respect to his predecessors that his predecessors gave to their predecessors. So I think at this moment, I believe that we should be in one of those moments where we're not setting new precedents, but because we have a president in place who doesn't respect the office, that it's okay for his predecessors to do things that their predecessors wouldn't do for the sake of national information, national education, and social peace.
Mm-hmm. Tim Walsh, as we conclude the final 5 minutes of this conversation, let's pick up with the contemporary times, what we've seen in the news about President Trump's relationships with former presidents over his nearly 4 years in office now. What can be said, what more can be said about President Trump's relationships with his predecessors?
Well, one of the things that's so dispiriting as an historian is how little the president seems to understand history, and how unable he is to assess his own time in office as a measure against those who have come before him. There have been presidents who have faced unprecedented and difficult times, obviously Lincoln among them, but also Washington and Franklin D. Roosevelt. But when you feel the necessity to have to compare yourself and to adulate yourself, self-aggrandizement, it compromises the office to some extent. By infusing his personality in the process, he diminishes what it means to be president of the United States. It's ironic because, of course, what he wants to do is elevate himself, and he is moving, but he's moving in the wrong direction and diminishing the office in the process, so that whoever succeeds him will need to do an awful lot of repair. The office will be, as they might say in real estate, a fixer-upper.
Mm-hmm. Tim Naftali, now certain presidents seek more advice from former presidents than others. This president, what is your impression there? It's clear that he doesn't, right? He doesn't value those relationships, it seems, and then certainly doesn't seek advice. Is that your read on this?
Yes, it's my read, and I think all the evidence we have bears it out. My favorite example of an odd couple in this regard is when Bill Clinton asked Richard Nixon for his advice on how to deal with Russia. If you couldn't imagine an odder couple than that. Bill Clinton was dating Hillary Rodham when she was on the House Impeachment Committee staff. And Richard Nixon comes to the White House, and Richard Nixon's input on Russia was absorbed, and Clinton later wrote that he learned from it. If Bill Clinton could take Richard Nixon's advice on a problem that faced the nation that former president was an expert on, then I think any president should be prepared to talk to any predecessor on any issue on which they're expert, regardless of politics, let alone party.
Mm-hmm. How hard is it to imagine when Donald Trump becomes former president, whether that's in January of 2021 or 4 years past that? Is it hard for him? I mean, he will break precedents as well, don't we imagine there, Tim Walsh, as a former president?
Well, certainly, without question, there's a new book out on the President's Club called Team of Five. But I think Donald Trump won't be part of a team of six. I think he'll be by himself. I doubt very much. And in fact, I think he's made it clear that he would never have any plan to attend the dedication of the Obama Presidential Center. There'll be no ceremony unveiling the portraits of Michelle and Barack Obama and the White House collection. So he's basically said, I'll have nothing to do with anyone who's preceded me because they have nothing to offer me. So, yes, I would say that whatever happens, it will be his life going forward will continue to be unprecedented, because I can't imagine what he will choose to do as a former president. Will he want a talk show? Will he continue to travel the country with sort of a Chautauqua with big kind of tent activities and road shows? It's just difficult to know whether or not he'll maintain any kind of decorum as a former president.
Mm-hmm. Tim Naftali, we have almost a minute left. Your final thoughts here?
There was a lot of hope, or there was some hope at least, that the office of the presidency, the august nature of the office, would somehow change Donald Trump a little bit, that he would seek to learn in office as his predecessors have done. The best of our presidents are those that learn from the office and learn from their mistakes, because they're all human and they all make mistakes. There was that moment, some of us may remember that, there's a photo of President-elect Trump meeting with President Obama, and he has that deer caught in the headlights look. One hoped that just the heavy burden of the office to which he'd been elected would somehow shape his understanding of this responsibility, but it hasn't. Mm-hmm. And okay. It is so painful to see the trashing of the office continue now in the fourth year of this administration with little hope that President Trump's approach will change.
Tim Naftali of New York University, former director of the Nixon Library, Tim Walsh, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum here in Iowa. The two Tims, we thank you so much for your expertise, your insights from history, so that we can hopefully prop ourselves up through this current crisis. Tim Walsh, Tim Naftali, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Tim.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.